Welcome to the Time Bubble Podcast, the only podcast where the guests get to travel in time. I'm your host, Jason Ayres, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by another author, and not just another author, another time travel author. So welcome, Keith A. Pearson.
It's lovely to be here, Jason. Thank you for inviting me on.
Yes, great. Great to have you here. So tell us a little bit about your books.
Oh, wow. I always struggle with that question because you think as an author, you'd have a fairly stock answer. But I guess they are, you could broadly describe them as low fantasy. So, you know, we touched on time travel. So it's an every man who happens to find himself in an extraordinary situation, being flung back in time or whatever it may be.
Yes, and I think we're very similar in that respect, because looking at the time travel genre, there are sort of specific areas which you could see. So, for example, within the time travel romance category, which is not really us, I'm sure you've seen what I call the Highlander romance. There are thousands of these Mills and Boone type books, and they all seem to follow the same plot of a woman thrown back to the Scottish 19th century. They always have a guy with massive rippling muscles on the front cover. But we don't do any of that. Ours is more about the man in the pub, really, isn't it?
And it's very much the sort of middle-aged guy who's probably not, you know, achieved everything or half of what he intended to in life. So certainly most of the characters, if not all of them, are all sort of fairly average is a good way of describing them. They are just average blokes who find themselves in extraordinary situations.
Yeah, you and me both. So I would say to anyone listening that if you do like my books, go and check out Keith's, because chances are you're going to like those as well.
And Ditto.
Yeah, good. Well, now that we've done the bit of mutual marketing, we'd better plug on with the podcast, which is great, because just like what we write about every day, we are talking about traveling in time. So in a way, you're going to get the opportunity today to be almost like one of the characters in your own novels.
Would be interesting, depending on which character is, I suppose.
Exactly. Okay. So what we're going to do, first of all, is give you three different days of your own life that you can revisit. If you could go back and live a day again, which day would it be?
So this is one day I get to go back and experience that day.
Yes, you can experience that day. People interpret this in different ways. Some just like to go back and live a day over again. Others sometimes think, well, is that a day where I could do something differently or change something? It basically interpret it as you will.
As I wish. Right. Yeah. Okay. So I've got my own time machine and I can set the rules.
Yeah.
So it probably won't surprise anyone to hear that one of my earliest memories of a significant day in my life was in the 80s. And it was the Christmas of my 13th birthday. And on that particular day, I opened up a box, which was wrapped, obviously, in Christmas paper. And I unveiled an Oric Atmos home computer. Yes, and I guess most people will think, you know, what is everyone thinks about Commodore 64s and ZX Spectrums and the like, but they were very expensive. And my parents weren't particularly well off, so I think they bagged a bargain somehow on this Oric Atmos, which was a little known personal computer. But I could not have cared less. I mean, it was. Up until that point, my only experience of computers had been at school, where we had a couple of BBC Micros, as I think every school did.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it was normally sort of two or three machines to a class of 30. So at best, you'd be peering over someone's shoulder, just sort of staring at that screen, wishing you could get a go. Or the arcades, you know, video games in arcades, you know, and back then we're talking, you know, Space Invaders, Galaxians, that sort of, you know, very primitive type of stuff. So to have this device, which allowed me to play video games and all sorts of other, do all sorts of other things, was just the most incredible. And I can remember the feeling, the excitement. I wanted a computer and I never thought I would get one. And I think this was about the time that, do you remember the movie War Games?
Yes.
About a sort of computer. And that, I think I watched that. When did that come out? I must have been about 11 or so. And it just, it, that, I think, sparked my initial interest. And it was such a generational thing. And I don't think we've experienced anything like that. The dawn of the personal computer. This is really the, this was the genesis of everything that we, you know, we're talking now on Zoom. You know, and yeah, you can take, literally take everything back to that particular period in the 80s, the explosion of personal computers. So to be part of that was huge. And the, I, to this, I'm sure my wife won't want to hear this, but I don't think I've ever been quite so excited. It was just, it was a real thrilling moment. And I don't think I left my bedroom. I'm a teenager, so I don't think I left my bedroom for probably about 6 weeks after that.
Yeah, no, it was an amazing time. And it all happened so quickly because I'm about the same age as you. And 1984, I got a ZX Spectrum. So that was one of the most well-known. I mean, I don't remember the Auric Atmos, to be honest, but there were a lot of other computers around. There was something called a VIC-20. I can't remember exactly what that was.
That was the Commodore 64's little brother, I think. Yeah. With a very clean memory.
But technology developed so quickly because I can remember the first time I saw a digital watch was something like about 1976 and a pocket calculator. But it was the guy, Clive Sinclair, who made the Spectrum. I believe he did invent the first pocket calculator or the first mass market one. But that time back in, like you say, 1984, the games market was just beginning.
Yeah.
Because it was all new, it was innovative. And unlike now, where the games industry is just this massive, bloated giant, which rather like Hollywood, that just keeps churning out superhero movies, it's just churning out more versions of Call of Duty and driving games and, you know, the big sellers and
franchises.
On those early games, people were just literally inventing the different types of games.
Well, the genres didn't exist, did they? You were literally creating genres.
Yeah.
So it was so exciting, and it really did feel like we were, you know, at the beginning of something incredible.
Yeah.
It was an amazing time.
It was. I mean, I had friends. We used to go round to each other's houses and we'd have the tapes and we'd be loading them up and copying the tapes and all the rest of the stuff that used to go. But I remember, do you remember W.H. Smith used to have a big computer section and they had all the computers set up down there? They were where we bought most of our games from. And I don't know if you did this prank as a schoolboy where you'd go into Smith's and you'd because you could program these machines. So you'd go up to the machine and you put 10 print, some obscenity, and then 20 go to 10. So it would just keep scrolling up and up on the screen. And if you were clever enough, you could actually program it so that the shop assistant wouldn't be able to break in and stop it. All very childish, but a lot of fun. Yes, wonderful times. So, okay, that's great. Let's move on then, and you can tell us about your second day.
Okay, so I need to reference my list here. So this will be going forward. This is going forward a few. All of my my days are actually in my sort of teenage years. I think since the advent of sort of digital photography and smartphones and everything else, we seem to sort of capture every moment of our lives. But people of our generation, there are whole swathes of primarily our youth that just remain undocumented. You know, there's very little photographic evidence, nothing really. So that from that period, I think the memories are, because they're only in my head, they seem to be slightly, I've got nothing else to reference them. So they tend to be more poignant, I think. But the second one would be. Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, in some ways, that's a good thing. There's too much, you know, everything is filmed now, everything is recorded. The 80s was probably the last decade where we sort of had that freedom. And, you know, in some ways, I don't think I would want everything that I did in the 1980s being on camera, or, you know, because we did embarrassing things as teenagers, but thankfully there's no record of them, so we got away with it.
There is that. My second, talking about embarrassing, so my second one would be, this would be January 1987. Now, I am unfortunately a fan of one of the most unfashionable and, I'm afraid to say, unsuccessful football teams of all time. So Aldershot were formed in, I think, 1926, and they went bust in 1991 and then reformed in 1992. So we've got almost 100 years of history in which we've never really achieved very much, never really troubled much higher than the sort of second to bottom and bottom rungs of the football ladder. Obviously, we've gone bust, never been to Wembley. So as unsexy a football team, you couldn't wish to follow. But this particular season, we were drawn against Oxford United. And at the time, they were in the equivalent of the Premier League. And we were a lowly team at the bottom of the football ladder. So it was a real sort of David and Goliath. I remember what happened is that they tripled the prices because there was a limit on the attendance. So a really poor crowd, absolutely freezing cold January day. But, you know, against the odds, we won that game 3-0. And my unfashionable little team that by that point I'd supported for sort of 3 or 4 years, was suddenly in the national media. You know, it was on, we were on TV, the highlight. I mean, it was incredible for somebody who, you know, just been watching this team battle out 0-0 draws against the likes of Halifax and York and, you know, other sort of bottom feeders, to have this experience, this exposure, was just incredible. So it remains one of my highlights as a football fan, and indeed, you know, as a young man as well. It really, really stuck with me.
Yeah. Well, remarkably, that match to most people has probably long since faded into obscurity. But I just happened to be, having been born and bred in Oxford, an Oxford United supporter. Maybe I'm the first Oxford fan you've ever met. Yes, I do remember that day well. Now, I wasn't at the match because it was an away match. So at the time, everyone in Oxford was really into the football, and I did have a season ticket, and we used to go every week. And just to talk a little bit about Oxford, for the majority of their history, they have been similarly unsuccessful. So they came up from the non-leagues in the 60s, and they sort of just were in the sort of third division for years and years and years. And then they had this remarkable run of success, and I'll come on to why in a moment, because there's a story about that. In 1983 and 84, they won consecutive third and second division titles, and suddenly they were in what is the equivalent of the Premier League, which was remarkable. And along the way, they had these amazing cup runs where they were knocking out Manchester United and people like that as well. So we had this amazing run. The first year that we were in the top division, we won the League Cup, which I went to Wembley to see. And we similarly were seen as underdogs that day. But we went and won 3-0 against QPR, who were sort of higher than us in the league at that time. So it was an amazing time. They lasted 3 years, and then the money ran out and they went downhill. Now, I don't know if you know where Oxford's money came from, but it was from a certain Mr. Robert Maxwell.
I do remember reading something about the Thames Valley Royals.
Yes.
I think he was talking about Reading and Oxford amalgamating them. I seem to remember stories of that, and I certainly remember Maxwell's name popping up.
Yes, well, the amalgamation of Reading and Oxford was not popular amongst both sets of fans, as you can imagine. And I remember to this day, I don't know if it's still there, but there was some graffiti in a builder's yard in Oxford, which was there. It was there for donkey's years, and somebody had painted on the wall, "Maxwell can stick his Thames Valley Royals up his arse." But anyway, unfortunately, when Maxwell took his dive over the side of the boat Not only did he take the Daily Mirror pension fund with him, all of Oxford's money went as well. So they went plummeting down and ended up falling out of the Football League into the non-leagues by 2000.
So yeah, our paths have crossed subsequently, but I think you're back where you
More or less exactly where they were when I first found out they existed about 48 years ago. So it's all been pretty pointless, really.
but at least you had your highs. We never had any highs. It has literally been 100 years of the only time we actually had any success is when we went bust and had to start at the very bottom of the football pyramid and then clamber back up. And, of course, we still had a decent – hardcore support. So we would, go to grounds that had a typical attendance of 100, and 1,000 Aldershot fans would descend. Yeah. Those were good times. We were a big fish in a small pond, but very quickly. And then we actually got back into the Football League, which was remarkable. Nobody had any plan what to do when we got there. It was like, we're here now. Now what? And of course, a couple of years later, the wheels fell off. Back into long league we fell. So, but at least you've had your day at Wembley, got to rub shoulders with the footballing elite. We're still playing the likes of, I'm trying to think of some of the names now, Chorley and Ilkeston and the like. So,
but you did
not good times.
You had that moment in the sun that day against Oxford, and I remember the day well because I wasn't there. So, when that result came in, I was watching Final Score on Grandstand, and it would have been probably Des Lynam in those days. I couldn't believe it when we sort of saw the result. It was like, that was quite a big thing, because what a lot of people probably don't remember was that the Cup was a much bigger deal in those days. You didn't have top flight sides putting out weakened squads
play.
So it was it was a genuine victory. We weren't playing our B team, so fair play. I
think I remember, wasn't it John Aldridge's last game before he went off for a big money move to Liverpool?
He went to Liverpool, and I can't remember if we had Dean Saunders then or if he came later, but we had quite a few internationals in our squad. There was Billy Hamilton, who played for Northern Ireland and various other things. It was
the deep grass of old football nostalgia now.
Yeah. Well, I can remember every name of every player in that team in the 1980s. And I'd struggle to name any of the current team because I'm just not as interested in football as I once was.
I'm with you there. I think the trouble is now it's so much more, it's so money led, and it's the players that they're not there for anything else than the money. There are these sort of times where somebody would grow up, play for their hometown club for their whole career. Those days are pretty much gone, I think, which is, understandable. The career is short. You've got to make as much money as you can. So it's a very different sport these days.
I think you can say that about a lot of sports, can't you? I mean, it's all very manicured. You look at things like Formula One, you're never going to get another James Hunt or Alex Higgins or any of those types of personalities, are you? So more's the pity. It's probably why we write so many books about the 1980s, because they were so great. And that's not just old blokes.
Life was better.
I know that any young people, it's just two old blokes talking about the good old days. Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. All right, well, let's move on then, and you can tell us about your third day.
Okay, so this would be a day in June 1989. So my best mate Dave and I decided in our wisdom that we were going to be famous DJs. And we were both working in retail at the time, and we quit our jobs, and obviously pre-internet days here, and via, I think it was Dalton's Weekly or something, we found an advert for cheap flights to Malaga. And with no plan, we got on a plane, and first time either of us had got on a plane, and we got a flight to Malaga, and we found ourselves in the delightful resort of Torremolinos, which is... I don't know how to describe it. It was just a a shithole, I think is probably the best way. But, you know, after a couple of weeks, you know, I managed to get a job as a DJ in this awful dive nightclub. They was doing what they call propping, which was dragging poor tourists into clubs. And for, you know, I think it was probably about 6 weeks, we were having just the most amazing time. Two 18-year-old guys, you know, footloose, fancy free. And the particular day in mind, I just finished working. I think I finished at 4 a.m., and there were a lot of Brits our age out there at the time working, and we sort of got to know one another, and we would all congregate on the beach after we finished work, which is about 4:30 in the morning. And we'd have beers and yeah, and we'd just watch the sun come up, basically. And I remember one particular day we were doing this, and just that feeling of just being completely and utterly carefree. And I think to this day, I don't think I've ever been completely and utterly carefree. I think you want, you know, certainly once you have kids, you pick up a mortgage, you have a career, you know, you're always carrying some modicum of worry with you. But then it was such an incredible experience just watching, you know, watching the sun come up, knowing that, you know, nothing to do for the day but sleep and mess around with mates and get drunk, and then you would carry on doing that. I mean, the whole thing did not end well. If you can remember Kevin and Perry Go Large.
Actually, well, watched it last week, funnily enough, because we were away on holiday, and we were looking for something to watch on Amazon Prime, and I thought my teenage son might enjoy it, which he did.
It's a brilliant film.
Yeah.
It has actually aged pretty well, I think.
Yeah, because it's 20 years or more.
Yeah. And it was a bit like that, but with also, if you've seen the In-Betweeners movie, it was a bit of that as well, too. Yeah. You know, so it's the first time we'd even been on a plane, let alone been away from home and all this sort of stuff. So it was a proper adventure. And, you know, for all the time we were there, we had the most amazing time, did all the things that, you know, your typical 18-year-old lads would do. It was just unbridled and wild and incredible. And then it all came to a grinding halt, and we had to come home. But yeah, that as I said, that particular day, I would give anything to have that feeling again, where you just don't, you can't see it. There's nothing on your horizon, not a single cloud. And as I say, I think it's, you know, it's just adulthood, isn't it? You're going to pick up that stuff. But I would dearly love to go back to that particular day and experience that feeling of just not having anything to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, one of my probably greatest regrets, well, I suppose it's not a regret really, but of having experienced similar, is not appreciating it as much at the time.
Because 100%.
You just don't know, do you? You don't realize. You see the parents with responsibility, but when you're sort of 17, 18, 19, there's this disconnect. You don't think you're ever going to be that.
Youth is wasted on the young.
Youth is wasted on the young, yeah. I mean, I think my equivalent experience would have been in the summer of 1987, when I took quite a leap into the unknown, and I went on one of those PGL holidays. Do you remember those? Yeah. So I went to the south of France, and it was one of these things where it was quite a brave thing to do, because I didn't go with anyone that I knew. So my dad took me down to Waterloo, effectively got on a coach with about 40 or 50 other 16 to 18-year-olds. And we went down to France, and we all bonded and made friends on the coach. And then we spent a week sort of windsurfing on the Med, and then we spent a week canoeing down the Ardèche Gorge. And every night was sort of a party, and girls and boys getting together. We were just at that sort of coming of age thing. And I mean, I never saw any of the people that I met on that holiday again, or even really stayed in touch with them, because this is another thing that we didn't have social media.
Yeah.
Now you'd be adding them on Facebook, and you'd still be texting. So it was like a 2-week microcosm with a group of people, just a snapshot, and that was it. But I remember on that holiday, there was no worries about school or jobs or work. It was just pure enjoyment. And you try to recapture it, don't you? Because that, I mean, that was probably the last time I was completely free. We talk about Kevin and Perry Go Large. I did do the whole Ibiza thing in the mid in the mid to late 90s. I went on what would be probably frowned upon by some people, the equivalent of a Club 1830 holiday. And I was getting to the upper part of that age range by then. It was about 2 years before the film came out. And it was every bit similar to what the film portrayed. And now, you see, I had a career and a job and a house then. But so it was only a holiday. But it was possible, you know, to sort of pretend all of that had gone away. Yeah. And, I would say that particular holiday was the last time I really had that sense of complete freedom. And then proper adulthood kicked in. But I managed to mess around until I was sort of in my early 30s. So I did quite well. But
for anyone listening to this who's thinking, anyone younger than us is thinking, my God, is this my future? Yeah. What I would say actually is things have, I think between the ages of sort of 25 and 45, you've got a lot going. Most of us have got a lot going on. Yeah. But I found this, I turned 50 last year. In fact, it's my 51st birthday next week. And I have found over the last 4 or 5 years that actually things have eased back a bit. So I'm starting not to, again, it may be an age thing. Well, I'm starting not to really care about the stuff that bothered me and that has bothered me. I'm not that fussed too much about having, you know, I try and keep a lot of negativity out of my life. I don't watch the news. I think you get to the point where you think, you know what, right, I can protect myself from a lot of this worry and stress and grief. And that's, you know, one reason why I do the job I do is because I can, you know, hide myself away and talk to my imaginary friends all day. And that's kind of cool. I don't have to put up with, you know, kind of people who cause me stress throughout most of my career.
No, I mean, writing these books for a living is a wonderful job to do. The only thing I really miss about the office days is the sort of the social side of it. But that may wasn't as good. But working at home, it can be quite isolating. So you do need to find other ways to interact with people.
I think December is a tricky month. You tend to see a lot of people on social media, you know, talk about work parties and office parties. And yeah, I do get a pang of envy there because I do remember working in office. December was always a good month because it was really, really quiet. But, you know, there was always, you know, parties or drinks or whatever it may be. And I kind of missed that element of it, but the rest of it, absolutely not.
There's no way. I mean, my biggest fear in life now is that one day my books are going to stop selling and I'm going to have to get a job.
that is a recurring nightmare, I've got to be honest.
Horrifying thought.
Yeah, it literally is. but it's also a very, very strong motivator to sit down every day and carry on writing. People say, how do you do it? You think, well, you didn't know the job I had before you realise I don't want to be going back to that. So that for me is definitely a motivator.
Definitely. Okay, well, those were three great days and we had a lot in common to talk about there. So that was good. So we'll move on to the second part now. And the next question is, if you could be someone else for a day, past, present, or even future, who would you choose to be?
Well, notwithstanding the fact that I'm not a deeply religious man, I would love to be God for the day. Now, whether you believe in God or not, I think what humanity needs is someone just to appear and say, sort yourselves out. I don't know what it is. I think maybe over the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, we've just become so entrenched with our views. Everyone just is so angry and bitter. And I think what the pandemic has taught us, in fact, if you look at the pandemic as a whole, it literally showed how amazing humans can be when we all work together for the common good, but equally how tribalistic and selfish and self-centered we can all be as well. I mean, it literally was both ends of the spectrum. And I just wish that we would all learn to be a bit more cooperative and more the amount of money and resources and effort that should be put into things that really matter and not into things that actually don't really matter. This is me standing on my soapbox now. This is probably as political as I'll ever be. But it is frustrating. And the older you get, you start to realise again that, you know, a lot of the stuff that people argue about really doesn't matter.
No.
It's much nicer just to wake up in the morning, have a smile on your face, and, you know, just live your life without all the constant bickering and tribal adversary and everything else that seems to go on. Maybe I think social media's got a lot to blame for all of this. Yeah. But so if I was God, I'd definitely do something about Twitter and Facebook. Yeah.
I think that the problem started with Brexit, and we've had several things since then, such as COVID, culture wars, as you call them, which cover all sorts of things, and then there's been all things, you know, there's been the BLM stuff, and there's been the Ukraine stuff, and I think what's happened is debate is no longer allowed. It's like that you have to take a point of view, so you're either totally for something or totally against. The idea of how two blokes been out at a pub, and one of them can be supportive of a thing and the other can't, and you can have a chat and you can have a discussion and then agree to disagree and have a pint. Yeah. That's, we've lost that now. And it's like this is where the whole cancel culture's come from. And it's like, so you've got one people, you know, so it's like, let's poke fun at people that support Brexit and call them gammons, or let's poke fun at young people and call them snowflakes. And it's like, I'm on this side of the argument, therefore these people are my enemy. And that has really got bad. And I don't think it used to be like that. Like I say, I think Brexit was the first time I noticed it, but then we've just had one thing after another, haven't we?
It seems to me that the factions of society are growing, and people are becoming more entrenched in those factions. And many, many years ago, when I first started my job in sales, my boss at the time gave me a bit of advice. He said, you've got two ears and one mouth, and you should remember that and use them in that order. In other words, listen to what people are saying, talk less. And that has always stuck by me. And I thought, you know, that advice is probably as profound today as it was then, because people aren't willing to listen. You know, they want to spout their opinions, whatever they may be. But nobody really wants to listen. And this is, I think, the problem. And social media has just amplified it. So you can go on to sort of, if it wasn't for the fact that a lot of my readers hang out on social media, I'd probably not bother with it.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of very angry, shouty people who have no interest in hearing opinions. They just want to shout about what they want to shout about.
And I think they think that the person that shouts the loudest will have the most impact. Yeah. So you can get a relatively minority or group of people that can shout so loudly about something because they want to make everybody think that that's how everybody else thinks. And it just, like yourself, I don't watch the news for that reason. And I try and avoid as much of this stuff as I can because life is too short.
It is. When you actually look at what the big picture in life, and God, there's just so much more to be. People are just so angry and unhappy, I think, and that annoys me. You think, God, you know, just take a chill pill and these things are important. And I'm not trying to denigrate the people's feelings about certain subjects, but yeah, you're not going to achieve anything. Do something about it if you really want to do something about it. Don't just scream on social media. Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, call people names or whatever it may be. If you want to do something about something, do something about it. Actually get out of your chair, put your phone down, and be proactive about it. And you'll feel better about yourself, and you'll actually you'll be doing some good in the world.
Quite right.
Okay. You know, that's the end of my sermon.
No, very good. Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. So one last question. If you could go anywhere in time, where would you go?
Right. Okay. This would be May 1939, and to a small town in Hampshire called Fleet. And the reason I would go there is because that's where my grandmother lived at the time, and she had a relationship with a Canadian airman. And then 9 months later, my dad was born. Now, whoever that Canadian airman was, his name never reached my dad's birth certificate, and my nan sort of married later on in life, and we all had my nan's maiden name, Pearson. she married on to somebody else down the line. But I think, again, this is something that comes with age. I lost all my grandparents by the time I was 16. So there was always that sort of disconnect, which didn't bother me so much. You know, you don't think about it when you're that young. But as I got older, it's sort of, you know, I have that sort of barrier now, that void, actually, rather than a barrier, between me and my, you know, my previous generations. And a few years ago, I started doing a family tree on Ancestry.com. And on my mother's side, I realized it literally generation after generation of farm laborers back for years and years and years. So I was particularly uninteresting. On my paternal grandmother's side, my great-grandfather hailed from Scotland, and there was, again, fairly uninteresting, but they all lived in and around, I think it was Inverness. But the mystery remained this Canadian airman, whose name is a mystery. My nan took it to the grave. We'll never know who he is. And there's a whole part of me that wants to know. I have particular traits. You know, how did this ability to write books? I mean, nobody in my family, even my extended family, has ever written anything. So it must have come from somewhere, you know, physical traits, all these sorts of things. I look around at my cousins and think, well, you know, not really that much alike. And so there's this big gap, and I virtually no hope of ever filling it. So if I could go back in time to one particular period, the temptation would be go back to the 80s and relive my days on that beach in Torremolinos. But I think absolutely, I would love to go to 1939.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. Playing detective in time,
yes.
which is a theme I've thought about putting into a book at some point, but I haven't got around to it. But
I think there is a guy. I forget. Can't remember his name off the top of my head. But he writes genealogy mysteries, yeah. And he's really into all this kind of stuff. I'll pop you his name over so you can add it to the podcast notes. But Nathan something rather. But he's really into that type of stuff, and he's a couple of his are on my to be read pile. My to be read pile, which is now about to hit three digits, I think.
Yeah. Okay, that's really good. Now, before we go, where can people find your books?
Okay, so if you want to find out about my books and me, probably the best place to go is Amazon. You can go to Amazon, of course. It's my website, which is keithapearson.com or co.uk, if that's your preference. Or you can just go to Amazon. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. If you have anything to discuss as far as politics or religion or anything like that's concerned, please don't come and find me. If you want to talk about biscuits and time travel and nostalgia and general nonsense, then please do come and find me.
That sounds great. Well, I'll put all of that in the show notes.
Cool.
And hopefully you'll get a few book sales. I'd like to think this podcast reaches people and we have an impact, but who knows?
At very least, it's always nice to have a chat with a fellow miserable middle-aged author. We don't get out much, do we, as a rule? So, yeah.
No, but we find plenty to write about. So
exactly.
We lived in good times. So.
Indeed.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming along today.
My pleasure.
A great chat. And thanks very much, and I'm sure I'll speak to you again soon.
Sure you will. Cheers, Jason.
Many thanks. Bye.